What a Monday we're going to have on golf today. First things first, European Solheim Cup captain Suzanne Pedersen makes her four captain's picks live on our air as her squad looks to capture the Solheim Cup on American soil this fall and make it four straight for the Europeans. How about the performance from recent LPGA Tour Hall of Famer Lydia Ko after winning gold at the Olympics? Ko taking the AIG Women's Open at the home of golf. Where does her win at St. Andrews rank among the best in her career? Plus, the Ryder Cup captain, Keegan Bradley, now could be a playing assistant for the President's Cup after his win yesterday at the BMW Championship. What will the U.S. team decide to do with their six picks? Heck of a show as Golf Today starts now.
Golf Today.
Hey, hey, happy Monday to you and yours. Welcome inside our Golf Channel Worldwide headquarters. I'm George Savarikas, pleased to be sitting alongside Ryan Labner as you're watching Golf Today. We got a special edition of the show with those Solheim Cup captain's picks coming up. European captain Suzanne Pedersen is going to make those live on our air. And what a weekend we had. It was a good combination with the AIG Women's Open. I feel like as a fan, there's nothing better than to watch golf played at St. Andrews or get to experience playing there. And then on the men's side with the BMW Championship, there's nothing more fun to see than mountain golf and guys hitting 400-yard plus drives. And the two winners we had and the drama we had, I mean, you couldn't have asked for a better script. Lydia Ko's road to the LPGA Hall of Fame. Majors are worth 2 points. She has three of those. So you see 6 points total, 18 LPGA Tour wins. They're each worth a point. Two-time Player of the Year, two-time VAR Trophy winner, and the Olympic gold medal. So that's 29 total points. She clinched her Hall of Fame spot with the Olympic gold earlier this month. So, Ryan, I know you love playing the comparison game and trying to figure out what would be, say, the best victory of a player's career or maybe most impactful. Where would you say this stacks up for Lydia Ko?
I think it's right up there with the Olympic gold. She's such a different player than she was a decade ago or even a decade and a half ago. And I'm always impressed by athletes who are child or teenage prodigies, and then they go on to not just meet expectations, but sometimes even exceed the outsized expectations that you have for those athletes. Whether it's, I think of Tiger, I think of LeBron, I think of Bryce Harper, I think of Serena Williams. Those were players who were can't-miss players in their teenage years, and then they went on to achieve great things. Lydia Ko was the most dominant teenager we have ever seen in the history of the sport, and yet here she is now, almost a decade and a half later, at 27 years old, and she's still central force in the game. And it has not been this linear trajectory, right? She has rifled through clubs and coaches and caddies. She was lost in the wilderness for a couple years. She went 8 years without a major championship victory. She's had, as we just saw in that graphic, the Hall of Fame sort of lingering over her head as well. But she has emerged from that a fully formed, well-adjusted adult. You know, she has not been broken by burnout or pressure. She's not been distorted in any way by fame. She has been and is as elegant of a player and a person as she was when she started, when she first broke on the scene in her mid-teens. I think that's quite a legacy to leave, and it really doesn't matter which victory is better, because we look at the totality of her career, it's legendary in one word.
And she's one of the most respected voices in the game. I always thought it was fascinating how her career trajectory seemed to mirror Jordan Spieth when they first burst on the scene back in 2015. They both had these very endearing personalities, the precociousness of youth. Spieth with two majors in 2015. Ko won a major end of 15 and the first one in 16. So they had similar achievements at such an early stage of their careers. They both then had kind of ebbs and flows and dips, either swing change or loss of performance and whatnot. Now they're at a very different stage of their career. And it's been amazing to see Lydia Ko have this bounce back season to some degree, winning an Olympic gold, winning her third major, ending that 8-year drought, putting the finishing touches now on a Hall of Fame career. It's like if this is the last image where in the sun at the very end, she makes the birdie putt at St. Andrews to now have the AIG Women's Open, then it could be the final chapter on what's been an incredible career. But she's playing such good golf right now, and I know on the men's side, we're waiting for Jordan Spieth to have that rebirth, and it hasn't happened. And with Lydia, to have it come full circle, to once again be playing the game at such a high level is a testament to her fortitude to go through the darkness to ultimately see the light again.
Yeah, and just to continue the Spieth parallel, there has always been something with Jordan and Lydia's game where it's almost hard to quantify their artistic value or the magic that they have. If you look at Lydia Ko, she's not particularly long. She's not like a Nelly Korda in that respect. She's not particularly accurate. She wasn't like Annika in her heyday. She has never been the best putter on the LPGA like an Imbi Park was. And yet she has this artfulness, there's a timeliness, there's a clutchness. You look at the way that she played those last three holes in the highlight, whether it was the up and down behind 16, the dart three wood into 17, the worst of the conditions, the tidy wedge into 18, and then having the fortitude, having the poise, having the clutch factor to be able to make that left to right slider when everything was on the line. That was what we saw from Jordan Spieth that he's had such a difficulty sort of recapturing over these past couple years, where that magic has never left Lydia Ko's game.
And now the question will just be going forward, how much fire does she have to continue competing at such a high level? Because everything that the game of golf asks you to be a top 10 player in the world and a major champion, I mean, that is such a big commitment. And it's easy to make that before you're married and look potentially with family life down the road. It's harder to be as self-serving when it comes to the commitment that the game asks of you if you're going to be one of the greats. And she currently is a great. I know golf fans would love to see her 5, 10, 15 years down the road. Only she knows inherently how long the ride is going to go for. But now she has 3/5 of the career Grand Slam. Is that going to be a big motivator for her going forward? What are the motivators? I mean, this 2024 year now rivals what she did in that run from 15 to 16. It's been just such a joy to watch.
It absolutely has. And I don't think anyone would have blamed Lydia Ko if she had like the mic drop moment after she won the Olympic gold. And she said, no. You know, I'm not going to retire right now. I still want to win another major championship. 2 weeks later, she wins at the Home of Golf, one of the most special championships that you can possibly hold. She has always sort of regretted putting out in the air, like, yeah, I'd like to retire before the age of 30. She said, I just sort of said it. It didn't mean anything at the time. I think it was more a clue into, hey, I've got other interests outside of golf. I want to have an entire second chapter to my career. You look at her major championship record. She has top three finishes in the other two majors that she has not won. That is a pretty special carrot that you can dangle in front of a player. Will that take a couple years to pick off? Will that take a half decade, a decade to pick off? Only she is going to be sort of in charge of that. I don't know how much longer she has to play, but we need to cherish it for as long as she does, because she's such a special player.
And it's a big jump when you go from 2 to 3. Yeah. Then you just have 2 left in your crosshairs. Then it becomes more real of, yeah, okay, this is something maybe I want to make a concerted effort to chase for the remainder of my career.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
European Solheim Cup team fully taking shape today. A big day for captain Suzanne Pedersen with her 4 captain's picks to complete her 12-player team. Albin Valenzuela getting ready to make her Solheim Cup debut, while we have some returning vets with Emily Pedersen, Georgia Hall, and Anna Nordqvist, who will once again reprise her role as a playing vice captain. So you see those 4 captain's picks. Lav, what comes to mind with her selections?
What comes to mind, George, is that you have to appreciate Suzanne Pedersen as a captain. She doesn't get bogged down in advanced analytics or metrics. She talks a lot about heart and fire and composure and feistiness and new blood. And that's exactly what you see with the 4 additions that she has now on her team. Anna Nordqvist, I think, was probably a little bit controversial on the outside. To her, she called her a pretty obvious one, but as a playing vice captain, just all that goes into it, potentially taking a spot away from a player who's more informed. But she called her sort of a big sister role. Georgia Hall is a known quantity, at least in Suzanne Pedersen's mind. Emily Pedersen is a match play specialist, a player who played all 5 matches in Spain. I guess the wild card here is just the rookie in Albin Valenzuela. But you look at the way that she has played recently, 3 consecutive top 25s, was in the mix just this past week at the AIG Women's Open. It's hard to quibble with any of these picks. And then I think when you look at this full roster with just 2 newcomers, this is basically a team where Suzanne Pedersen knows what she's going to get. She knows she's had success, not just in Spain, but the previous 2 Solheim Cups as well. This is a very formidable team as it looks to make history and win 4 in a row.
Big picture, do you think that you almost need to do that when you're trying to win a road Solheim Cup versus if you're at home, then potentially you could have more rookies in the mix?
I think so. I think you want to go with some of the known quantities that you have. You know, when you get into a team room, you want to know who the potential pairings you're going to have. You don't want to be figuring that out week of or trying to figure out which golf ball you want to hit in alternate shot and that sort of thing. So I do think from Suzanne Pedersen's mind, again, she does not go necessarily by what the computer is spitting out at her. A lot of it is going to be instinctual. It's going to be in her gut. I look forward to talking to her just in a couple moments here, because when I covered the Solheim Cup last year, it was a talk among the reporters, like, wow, she's really bucking the conventional wisdom. When they got down 4-0 after the opening session, there was a lot of hand-wringing over the pairings that she'd sent out there, the order in which she was doing so, had she made the right choices that she'd actually put on the team. For them to come out then with a 14-all tie was certainly vindication and validation for what Suzanne Pedersen was trying to do as a captain.
Well, and we always have the knee-jerk reaction based on the first session, where one captain's a savant and the other captain's an imbecile based on this small snapshot of four matches when, big picture, there's 28 points on the line. So we really overvalue what you see very early on based on the entire composition of what the Solheim Cup entails.
And she, Suzanne Pedersen, does have the has the perfect temperament, where she's not easygoing, where if you do get into that 4-0 hole early, like, she's going to light a fire under you, make sure that you're locking in, making sure that you know that you're letting your team down, and this is not going to stand over the remaining four sessions that you're going to have. To me, like, Suzanne Pedersen is the perfect captain. You really don't want someone who's just spitting out what the computers are telling you. Yes, there's obviously a place for that, and that can inform some of your pairings. But ultimately, it's Suzanne Pedersen's legacy that's on the line, and she's trusting what she knows in her gut and in her heart, and I think that makes her a very effective captain.
And she's trying to do what Katrina Mathew did, and that's win back-to-back, one at home. She retained the cup and one on the road as well. I'm also fascinated by what goes into making these captain's pick selections. And also, there were two names that were on the Solheim Cup team last year, Gemma Driborough and Caroline Hadwall, who aren't on the team this year, and some of the other names that were maybe considered in the mix: Bronte Law, who's leading the Ladies European Tour order of merit; Alexandra Fosterling has had four LET wins. She's just 24 years old, dating back to last September. So she's kind of an ascendant name on the rise. And I know that you not only have to determine maybe who's in form, who's a veteran presence, how personalities will match. There's a lot of variables. And I feel like with Suzanne Pedersen, when you've just retained a cup, you've built up a lot of equity in that team room and just with the European squad in total, especially given her pedigree, having played in 9 Solheim Cups as well.
And isn't it interesting, too, the ebb and flow that you see of this event, where 6 or 8 years ago, the European team, it felt like they were just trying to fill out their 12-woman roster, where here is, now you mentioned the players who were sort of on the cutting room floor. You could have gone 14, 15, 16 deep with this European Solheim Cup team, as opposed to just sort of filling out that roster. I think it shows the European strength. A lot of them are under the age of 28 in the prime of their career. This looks like a team that potentially could be built to last as well.
Yeah, trying to get 4 in a row. They've won, 5 of the last 7, I believe. I mean, it's been quite the run of European dominance in the Solheim Cup. But they have been razor-thin margins in which they've been able to either retain or win the Solheim Cup recently. So here's the 12-player roster: Charlie Hull, Esther Henselit, who won the silver medal at the Women's Olympic Golf Competition. You see Celine Boutier, just some of the names that are on the roster. We're going to have Suzanne Pedersen, the captain, next. So we welcome in the captain, European Solheim Cup captain, Suzanne Pedersen. Suzanne, we just saw you make those 4 captain's pick selections. How many names were you considering before whittling it down to those 4 choices?
Well, it's always hard. There's a lot of great golfers out there, a lot of people that work hard, put in a lot of effort and dedication to kind of reach this big goal of theirs. And there was a long list to start. Obviously, it gets a little bit shorter as you get closer, but this was pretty much decided this last week. There's tough calls, for sure, probably the worst part of this job. But now, today, we sit here with the 12-girl squad, which is extremely strong.
Suzanne, you seem to sort of base your team as much on guts and instinct as you do advanced metrics. What did this particular group of 4 players show you that you wanted to make sure you had on your European side?
Well, we have a lot of experience in our top eight. We have two young players, new players, fresh blood into the team. Very strong players, Alban and Esther. Esther obviously coming off a very hot stretch in the summer, managed to kind of play herself into the team, which was her biggest goal for the year. Alban, who's had a very steady, solid year of the last 12 months. She was one that fell just short last year. So I think she was kind of inspired and kind of motivated to kind of make this one. And she's really grown into a fine, solid player, which will contribute a lot into the other players. Both Esther and Alban will complement a lot of pairings, which is important when you kind of look at the four picks. There's a lot of stats kind of that this is all based on, but I also look at a lot of other aspects like the camaraderie, that kind of what they bring to the team, obviously all the pairings options. It is a puzzle, I think we today stand with, I'm pretty sure and confident we stand with the 12 best players.
It sounds like it's part art, part science as the captain when you're trying to get those 12 players dialed for the Solheim Cup. And we know how different the environment will be from what you experienced trying to win a home Solheim Cup in Europe to what you're now going to see next month in America on foreign soil. How important was it to have a veteran team knowing that you're going on the road this time?
We all know it's very hard to compete and kind of win away. We've been kind of successful for the last three. We don't take that for granted. We will be ready. We are preparing. We know we're going to face a very hungry, kind of revengeful young American team. And we can't wait. I'm sure this year will be a big one. The crowds are going to be back to normal. 21 was a little different playing in the US with literally zero European fans along the course. But at the same time, you kind of find ways of enjoying it either way. I can't wait to kind of come to the US and for what they say, this will probably be the biggest one yet.
Suzanne, what do you think you did best as captain during your stint in Spain last year?
It's not easy. It's not an easy task to kind of get 12 individual players, people on board and kind of please everyone. And I thought it was a tough start. I don't necessarily think we played that bad. I mean, the Americans, they really played well starting off, and fair enough. That's how this game is. But I think we did a great job of kind of picking it back up. I think each and every player kind of took that responsibility and kind of led the way. And it was a team effort to kind of catch up with Americans, which is kind of what it felt like. It was a catch up for the remaining part. I'm just really trying to be me. The way I came across as a player, like probably a little bit feisty, hard, pretty direct. I don't necessarily hold back if I have something on my mind, and the players are getting used to it. And I think also from what I learned, that's kind of what they expect from me. You're trying to kind of be kind of overlooking everyone at the same time, trying to kind of get everyone fired up. So there's a balance between it all.
The European team has been on quite the run. You're trying to win a four straight. You've taken five of the last seven. With where things stand now, is this the golden age of women's golf in Europe?
Well, I think women's golf in general is in a fantastic place, both the American side and the European side. We are going to kind of try to create history once again, but we don't take anything for granted. It really takes hard work. It's amazing always, all the golf that's played over the 3 days, it literally comes down to putt or a shot or it's kind of getting the right balance at the right moment. And I always believed hard work will pay off. These girls, they all stand behind that. So, you know what, I think it's we will be ready in 2 weeks' time. The girls are extremely up for this task. We have so many great young players coming through. I think Esther is a great kind of example of a girl that's kind of played extremely well throughout the entire year, and then now coming off a really, really solid summer. So she has a lot of confidence and belief in her game, and she's just 1 out of 12. So it'll be fun.
Suzanne, you only have two rookies on the team, and you talked with Jamie Weir about how these young players don't particularly need much guidance. Why was it important for you to have Anna Nordqvist as a playing assistant captain once again?
I mean, I think you can just look at Anna's record. In the match play, you want her on your team and you want her on the course. She has everything a player needs to go out there and be dominant. She has done it before, she will do it again, 100%, and she wants to play. And if you want to play, you'll find a way to kind of be ready. And the experience obviously matters a lot. She knows what she needs to do. And the environment and the atmosphere, it all seems like, always seems like everyone finds kind of the little extra edge every single time to kind of have their best game that week. There's always more putts made than you ever see on a regular week. So there's just something special with the atmosphere and the team environment that kind of brings the best out of everyone.
With you, I mean, you've experienced as a player, you've experienced it as a captain. A road environment for team competition is so unique, to have a crowd at any time cheering against you. So the headspace that you had to go as a player to play your best in a road environment, how do you then share that with your team to prepare them for what they're going to see in a couple weeks?
Yeah, well, it is different. I always used to kind of get kind of pumped from the crowd going quiet. That was kind of a good thing. The more quiet, the better for us. And you kind of have to prepare, like, hopefully we're going to have a knowledgeable crowd that kind of appreciates good golf on both sides. But I mean, they are going to be louder. They are going to be cheering more for the Americans. Fair enough. We've all been there. But and I don't think the girls care, to be honest. They just want to go out there and kind of get their points. And we've told them, especially from Toledo, like, if we can kind of get silence on the golf course, I think we've done a great job.
The 1 week that you want to root for silence. Suzanne Pettersen, European yeah. Solheim Cup captain. Good to spend some time with you.
Thank you.
Coming up next on Golf Today, Ryan French of Monday Q Info is going to join the show. While the world's best on the LPGA Tour were competing at the Home of Golf, players were running hot in the first stage of the LPGA Tour's Q School. Ryan has the details on a tough week in Cali. Next. So while the LPGA Tour was in St. Andrews for the AIG Women's Open, the tour began its first stage of Q School on Thursday at Mission Hills Country Club and Indian Wells Golf Course. Poor course conditions, scheduling questions, and temperatures nearing 110 degrees left a lot of players frustrated. Ryan French of Monday Q Info put out a column detailing the situation. Here was his tweet: today was the first day of LPGA Q School, but poor course conditions, triple digit temps, and poor scheduling had players frustrated, angry, and wondering where the $800,000 in entry fees for the first stage is being spent. Ryan French now with us on the show, Monday Q Info. Ryan, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me on, guys.
So, Ryan, I guess there have been issues with Q School over the years. How did this kind of come to a head where it got your attention and just so many players voicing their frustration?
Yeah, it started with a message from a coach, George, and kind of went downhill from there. He was out there with his player and got some pictures. And, I mean, the conditions were pretty poor. Now, to be fair to the LPGA Tour, Jody Brothers, who runs Epson Tour, has done a great job over there. Had learned about it about a month out, and they got their agronomist involved. And the conditions, by all accounts, players included, thought, you know, the conditions improved drastically, but there's still multiple holes. The first four holes on the Palmer course at Indian Wells were, you know, almost virtually unplayable or pretty bad. There was sodded fairways and rough. In among those other things that I listed in the tweet, it's just for 90% of players, this is the most important tournament of the year, and to have those conditions is just unacceptable, in my opinion.
Well, and I had so many questions when I was reading your story. I think the first one, though, is why are they even playing in the California desert in mid-August when you know that the temperatures are going to be 110 degrees and agronomically the courses are not going to be at their best?
Yeah, I think that's the most frustrating part, Ryan, from the player's perspective. Is the reason, or it seems the reason is to save money. Courses in the desert, as you know, in the middle of August are, you know, cheaper to get. You have access to them. And so it seems like they took the entry fees, which were over $800,000. It's $2,500 a person. There was 330 players roughly at the first stage of Q School. They jam them onto three courses. And they make money from it. And I don't, it's no problem that the tour makes money from Q School. That money gets back, invested back into the tour. But to do that in the middle of an Epson Tour season, some of the players from Epson Tour had to come from Oregon, come play Q School, then go to Indiana. You know, all of these factors looked like they're trying to make as much money as possible from Q School. And that's very unfortunate. You're playing with people's careers.
To that point, Ryan, why was the LPGA even beginning Q School when the Epson Tour still has a couple of events left in its season and those players are trying to get to the LPGA that way? Why are those two events happening concurrently?
I think it, you know, from the outside and from, you know, talking to players, it seems like it's all back to, you know, the mighty dollar, right? You know, if you're below 125th on the Epson Tour money list, you have to go back to first stage. Like I said, they were in Oregon. Then they had to go to California for Q School, learn three different courses if they didn't play the previous year, and then go to Indiana this week to play. And so you're basically messing with a player's two seasons in a three-week span. They're already struggling this year, and now they have to think about Q School while trying to keep their card this year. It's just unfair to the players, quite frankly. They don't do it on the men's side. They don't do it in any other tour in the world, as far as I know, have a Q School in the middle of the season. You know, I think if you pay $2,500, if you make it through, you got to pay another $3,000, and that's fine. Those entry fees are pretty standard for Q School. But at the very least, with those prices, you should have decent course conditions and you should have a fair shake at scheduling and those kind of things.
Well, yeah, it's tough playing desert golf when most places are doing their overseed in mid-September, so it's only 2-3 weeks away. What has been the LPGA Tour reaction as this has gotten more momentum and more legs over the past few days?
Yeah, I have a great relationship with Jody Brothers, who has taken over the Epson Tour you know, last year, and he's done an amazing job. They've increased purses, they've lowered entry fees, and I'm very confident that they will fix this. But outside of my relationship with Jody, I haven't heard from the LPGA. I've heard that they are, that everything is on, you know, on the table to how to improve it. But I also think that these players need to have their voices heard. This is, you know, in my opinion, unacceptable. This is, you know, Sarah Kemp, longtime LPGA player, said, you know, I've never felt pressure like I have at Q School, and I can't imagine playing in conditions like that, you know, with that pressure on your career. So I think it's, you know, I think Jody has done a great, great job, and I hope the LPGA fixes it, because this just is not the way to run a Q School.
Yeah, Ryan, at the end of your well-reported story, you did strike a bit more of an optimistic tone. What sort of changes, I guess, do you anticipate in the future, or I guess in a dream scenario, What would you like to see this look like in 2025 and beyond?
Yeah, I mean, I think you got to have multiple first stage sites, Ryan. You know, the men's side has 12, and I don't think realistically that's the number. But, you know, you got to have one course. That's only fair. There's no Q school in the world besides the LPGA playing three courses. You know, you got to have multiple sites to save on travel for, you know, young players just graduating college, men's or women's. You got to have a place where they can drive to, especially on the ladies' side, because there's not a lot of money in the game. It's so expensive to go to Q school. You got to be able to have some regional-based first stage sites. So in a dream world, I would think maybe three or four first stage sites spread across the country on one golf course where players can come, have a couple of days of practice, and have a fair shake to get through, and not have course conditions be any sort of factor in whether you get through. You know, I can't imagine a career ending because of a bad break on a course that isn't up to the standards that the LPGA wants.
Certainly hope that wouldn't be the case. He is Ryan French of Monday Q Info. Ryan, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
It's time now for a Golf Today Roundtable chat as we say hello to my podcast partner, Rex Hoggard, who is soon to be heading up to Atlanta. Rex, you're going to be wishing you're in that air-conditioned home studio, but with the Tour Championship on deck, the PGA Tour's season finale, what's your biggest storyline, whether it's player, whether it's course, whether it's the top 30 field?
George, you probably missed this last week, but when Lab was at the BMW Championship, way up at that mile high air, we did the podcast and I was really worried about him. Almost to the point I felt like we needed to call the authorities. He was flushed. He didn't have any color in his face. He was breathing heavy. So I'm glad he's back in the studio and comfortable. Going to Atlanta next week,
level.
It's going to be the heat. Obviously, we're going to talk about, back at sea level, thankfully. We're going to talk a lot about the golf course, and I'm really curious. I did kind of a crash course this morning, sort of just looking at what Andrew Green did at that golf course, because it's suited a style of play for so long. We've talked about Xander Schauffele. He has so many strokes ahead of everyone else when it comes to this golf course. We've talked about how well Rory has played here. It clearly suits a style of player. I'm really, really curious if these changes are going to maybe bring the medium back in, where Scottie Scheffler is clearly not a fan of this golf course, but he talked yesterday before leaving the BMW Championship just about the idea of he wants to get there, he wants to see it, he wants to hope that maybe this golf course doesn't favor a certain type of play.
Yeah, for me, it was a pedestrian week for a lot of stars at the BMW Championship. Is that an anomaly based on the fact that we were playing at 6,400 feet elevation, the highest altitude of any course this year on the PGA Tour, or is this general wear and tear based on a long season and now we're getting ready for the final leg of the FedEx Cup playoffs? But is Scottie Scheffler going to bounce back and really rubber stamp what will be one of the best seasons we've seen on the PGA Tour in the last 15 to 20 years if he can finally break through and win a Tour Championship, a FedEx Cup playoffs, have 7 wins, 8 worldwide if you include the gold medal? So that would be my biggest storyline coming in the week. What about you, Lev?
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. When you think about last week at the BMW Championship, that did seem like a one-off. You saw some of the distance control issues that Scottie Scheffler and caddy Ted Scott were having. You look at Scottie Scheffler and the hallmark of his game, it is iron play, and in particular, it is his distance control. And to see him missing with even the shortest clubs, the frustration that was boiling over, yes, it's certainly an indication that sort of a long season is catching up with him, particularly sort of the condensed nature of the PGA Tour now returning to this calendar year schedule with the signature events, the majors, the Olympic tournament as well, and now in these three playoff events as well. It's a lot of golf in a very short period of time. I do think Scottie Scheffler is immensely motivated to get finally a FedEx Cup title on his resume. What do you think, Rex? If Scottie Scheffler does not win this week, or if Xander Schauffele does not win, the two leading protagonists of this PGA Tour season, are you going to be one of those guys who's howling for change that the PGA Tour needs to blow this thing up?
No, I agree with what Scottie said 2 weeks ago in Memphis. It's silly. It's not a season-long race. We can sit here and call it whatever we want. The season-long race ended at the Wyndham Championship. It's not a playoff. That word was never going to fit with golf. What the Tour has created, however, is something that's kind of cool during a time of year when our attention is clearly going in the direction of football, where you have the top players playing in pretty big markets. You go back to Denver last week, Memphis 2 weeks ago, Atlanta this week, playing for a significant amount of money where people are going to pay attention to it. That's it. End of list. Full stop. I think the idea that they're going to come up with some sort of system that's perfect, that's going to fit everyone, is ridiculous. We're not going to get there. This is silly, and they've done a really good job over, let's say, 2+ decades of coming up with a system that's better, but it's never going to be perfect.
We're looking at the top 10 in the standings. Rex, why isn't this a playoff?
I just don't think playoff as a concept ever really fit with golf, because you and I and Lav are going to sit around over the next couple of weeks and talk about the playoffs when it comes to football or baseball or whatever the case may be, and you would have a home field advantage. You would have the idea of a team getting hot at the right time. You would have a dark horse coming into the playoffs that you would like coming into this week. Justin Thomas is going to start this week way behind Scottie Scheffler on that particular golf course at Eastlake. He really doesn't have much of a chance. He said as much on Sunday when he left the BMW Championship. You like to think you have a chance, but it's not going to be much. You don't have any of those things with what we have here with the postseason, playoff, season-long race. Again, call it whatever you want to call it. I think what they've created is interesting. It's a compelling product, again, during a time of year when you normally wouldn't be paying a whole lot of attention to golf, but I don't think it's a playoff.
So no dark horse. Yeah, Keegan Bradley was 50th and just won, and now he's fourth. That's a Cinderella story. The home field advantage is the baked-in FedEx Cup points that guys accrue. You're never going to have a true – it's not like Scottie Scheffler can say, oh, we're going to go play my favorite course in Dallas because I'm in the top spot, but it's the points accrued that give him this semblance of what would be golf's version of a home field advantage. So I'm one who my thinking personally has evolved over time, where I think they're getting significantly closer with the format. I don't think they're 100% there. Last week I was working PGA Tour Live, and it was interesting. We had Justin Thomas's group early in the day. He's mic'd up. He's talking to Max Homa about potential format changes, and he was saying maybe Pebble Beach could be a future spot within the playoffs. Maybe they have rotating locations for a tour championship if they're ever going to touch the West Coast in the future. So I think the format is getting closer. The venues could be the potential shift that we see in the coming years. What about you, Lav?
I mean, I think that's something that we'd love to see, having a playoff system, a three-week playoffs on the West Coast in prime time for East Coast viewers. The biggest issues with that, of course, is FedEx is a huge sponsor of the PGA Tour. That wants to have its mark on one of the playoff events. Its corporation, it's headquartered in Memphis. You look at the Tour Championship this week, Southern Company, Coca-Cola, those are big sponsors for the PGA Tour as well. They obviously want to have it in the South, but moving it in locations in a more favorable time slot, I agree, would certainly be more favorable. I'm with Rex, who I think is probably with Scotty as well, and that I think this is a breakdown in how it's marketed and how it's sort of framed, calling it a season-long race. The PGA Tour Player of the Year Award is the season-long race. And so whether that's most likely going to be Scottie Scheffler, you can say that Scottie Scheffler was a season-long champion. This is fun. I like the FedEx Cup playoffs. I like how they've done it. I agree with you, George. I think it has gotten closer to what the ideal is. Can they make some tweaks to it? Maybe. Would Scottie Scheffler's lead be 3 or 4 shots more realistically if you had a computer sort of spitting that out? Yes. Does that make for a more compelling week of product at the Tour Championship? I don't know. They're trying to thread a very fine needle here of having an entertaining season finale while also crowning a winner who, no disrespect to Keegan Bradley, would not sort of be out of nowhere over the past couple of months.
And one final thought, I think, and we say this a lot with big events, venues matter. And I think for the FedEx Cup playoffs, we've seen venues change and evolve over time. And you would hope 5-10 years down the road, this is the first leg, this is the second leg, this is the third leg. There's some stability where fans then have an understanding and notoriety of what that represents in the grand scheme of the PGA Tour schedule and the playoffs having this elevated sense of importance. All right, what's our final topic, Lav? What are we going with?
I think, Rex, how about Keegan Bradley, the winner last week at the BMW Championship? There's a lot of conversation now. He's up to 10th in points, although the points are not officially rolling over now to the final week. They can certainly make an impression on Jim Furyk. Where are you going? If we had to make a decision right now, are you putting Keegan Bradley on that U.S. President's Cup team, or do you think they should go in a different direction?
I followed our colleague Mark Slaybaugh's lead. I did tiers. I know you're going to enjoy those as much as you like reading those. So in the first tier is Sam Burns and I think Tony Finau. They're pretty much locks as much as you can make a captain's pick a lock. And then the second tier is let's talk about it. tier, and that's going to be Keegan. It's going to be Russell Henley, and it's going to be Brian Harman. And I do think that Keegan ends up getting a pick. I thought it was an interesting conversation that you guys had earlier about the idea, does he deserve a pick based on 1 week performance at Mile High Air? Maybe not. However, he's still right there on the list, and he has to pick someone, and I'm tired of hearing you say it should be Nick Dunlap.
But it should be Nick Dunlap. If you want to get him in the system as a 20-year-old with a lot of runway still ahead of him, Nick Dunlap deserves serious consideration. He would be much higher on the points. I believe
this
he's 25th
preseason.
On the points because he did not receive the necessary amount of points for winning the American Express earlier this season. He would look markedly different. He'd be more in sort of that Denny McCarthy, Justin Thomas tier of players who are under consideration as opposed to now, at least on paper, he looks well outside the number.
I'd love to see, and I mean, you heard what we said earlier, Rex. I think Keegan Bradley 100% should be on, but in consideration, also another young guy, Akshay Bhatia, currently 14th. I think he's a name that should take some serious merit, depending on, are you going to go with guys who have experience, or are you going to try and start grooming who could be the next crop of core guys that are part of U.S. teams, not just for this year, but going forward for the next decade?
And Rex, we certainly talked about that more 10, 15 minutes on the podcast this morning. If you guys enjoyed conversations like these, plus a whole lot more, be sure to check out the Golf Channel podcast with Rex and Lab. We'll be doing another one on Wednesday live from East Lake. Also, George, they can chop this up, throw it on the Golf Today podcast, and you can always find us on YouTube.
No goodbye to Rex?
Nah. I've already talked to him enough.
So let's welcome in our Karen Stupples, who was on the call last week with the AIG Women's Open, of course, a 04 AIG Women's Open champ. Karen, you also played in two Solheim Cups. First, let's just start with the captain's picks made by Suzanne Pettersen. Mm-hmm. Any surprises to you?
Really, I don't really see too many surprises. I think Georgia Hall was a natural pick. Anna Nordqvist, obviously, with a lot of experience, and I think that's somebody who Suzanne really feels like she can lean on. So obviously she'll have to pare back her assistant captain's duties. Emily Pettersen, I think, has a personality that is quintessentially similar to Suzanne Pettersen. So that seems like a really natural fit. And Alban Valenzuela, over the past couple of years, has really kind of put herself in a position to make this team as well. And I think that those are some very well-rounded picks for Suzanne. So really no real surprises here at all.
Stubbs, when you look back 24 hours from what was the final round of the AIG Women's Open, what was your biggest takeaway from Lydia Ko's victory as well as some of the other contenders who faltered towards the end?
Well, I do think that when you look at Lydia Ko's game, it really kind of set up well for St. Andrews. I mean, she has a great sense of history, and I think that really rolls into her game in general. She really enjoys being creative with her shots. She has a short game that is the envy of everybody's. And I think, again, around St. Andrews on a golf course in some very tricky, nasty conditions, it really set up well for her game. I think those conditions played a big part in why some of the other players faltered coming down the stretch. I think Nelly Korda had it right there in the palm of her hands. If she doesn't hit it out of bounds on 16 on Saturday and doesn't have that double bogey on 14 on Sunday, I think it's an another unfortunate ending to Nelly Korda's major campaign for this season. And I think somewhat of it is an effort on her part to really push to try and make it happen, to try and make that victory, to make up for what happened at the US Women's Open. I think that she will rue this one, probably very much so. And if a player says that they can forget these near misses, they don't. They really sting, and I think this one will sting for Nelly.
Karen, Lydia Ko was, I mean, taking the victory lap, winning gold, obviously, with the Women's Olympic Golf Competition, getting her in the LPGA Tour Hall of Fame, but she was also saying, hey, I'm not done yet. I'd like to win another major. And it's amazing how the perception around someone's game can change that quickly to now she goes from two to three majors. She has 3/5 of the career Grand Slam, ends that 8-year major drought. How much do you think she has left in the tank going forward to now potentially reset her sights on the career Grand Slam?
Well, I think you really hit the nail on the head there, because all of us within the LPGA world were thinking, well, now she's made the Hall of Fame, maybe this will be it for her. Maybe she'll slowly slide off into retirement, because she's always talked at 30 as her magic number of when she wants to be retired by. So we thought, well, maybe it will just come sooner. She seems very settled in her home life, happily married, and she's got a dog. Everything seems to be working in the direction of retirement. But now you raise that specter of Grand Slam, and I really feel like that's something that Lydia Ko can really sink her teeth into if she wants to continue playing. It will give her another goal for which she will be working towards, and she's a player that needs these goals. She needs to have something to focus and zero in on, so that could be a really good one for her, and I have no doubt that that's going to be in her sights.
Karen, touching on something you just said about Nelly Korda, who has been the dominant player in 2024 on the LPGA, how will you remember her major season? As one in which she picked off another one, or a couple in which she really played poorly, or perhaps the one at the Old Course in which she kicked it away late?
That's a really tough question, because as a player, you need to and you have to remember the good. I mean, we've got to remember the 6 victories that she had. We've got to remember the leap into the pond, the lake that was at Chevron. But I think that it hurts. Crashing out of the US Women's Open, that was painful. And then at the Old Course, how many opportunities do you get to win an Open at the Old Course at St Andrews? I mean, those opportunities are few and far between. And I think that's one that will definitely sink in and will sting a little bit. It stings me for her, and I have a lot of sympathy for that, because I know how much she wanted it.
Karen, how critical is it to have venues like last year at Pebble Beach for the U.S. Women's Open, St. Andrews this year for the AIG Women's Open, to become a regular part of the landscape for what we see going forward with women's majors?
Well, we got a really good taste of it at St. Andrews, and that is you're able to put what these women do in context with a historical background of watching players play St. Andrews for years, for many Opens. And you can see how the challenging conditions can really impact how a course is played. But not only that, Pebble Beach, again, it's going back through history to remember the great shots that the men have played on those courses. And now you can see women hit great shots on these courses. Like, you'll remember Lydia Ko's up and down on the 18th at St. Andrews to win. That's pretty historic in its own right. So I feel like it's huge for the women's game, because it puts their game in historical context right next door to the men's.
Stubbs, that's the last major we're going to have for about 8 months on either the men's or the women's side. When you look at the LPGA major season in its entirety, what was the biggest takeaway to you?
How deep the LPGA Tour is in its talent level, and that, you know, that any given week, any player could step up and rise to the occasion to take one of those majors. I mean, we saw a veteran in Amy Yang take the KPMG Women's PGA Championship, a player that has for many years put herself in contention but wasn't able to get across the finish line, finally realize her goals. We've got so much young talent, but it's good to see a more experienced player go ahead and do the same thing. But it's just the sheer depth of talent that is out there on the LPGA Tour, the venues, as we've talked about, playing for these majors. And I do think that I can't wait to see it all happen again next year.
Yeah, it's been such a fun major season. Mm. And I would ask you for a Solheim Cup prediction, sneaking suspicion who you're going to pick. So we'll table that
let me think.
Until we have the Solheim Cup kicking off on September 13th. Always great to visit with you here on Golf Today, Karen.
Cheers, George. Thanks, Ryan.
Tomorrow on Golf Today, U.S. Solheim Cup captain Stacey Lewis will be making her 3 captain's picks for the red, white, and blue. You can catch all the coverage as Stacey joins us live on Golf Today tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Covered a lot of topics, so what's top of mind for you as our final thought as we're going to wind things down?
I think the big one for me was Suzanne Pedersen, the European Solheim Cup captain, filling out her roster with the remaining 4 captain's picks. And you can quibble with some of the choices that she had, whether she didn't necessarily take some informed players as opposed to maybe some of the more known quantities. You're going to have 10 returners on that European Solheim Cup team, but it's so refreshing because it's certainly on the opposite end of the spectrum with Stacey Lewis, who throughout her LPGA career has been sponsored by KPMG, a data insights company. Those two are just polar opposites in terms of how they approach the captaincy, how they approach their team building, and it's fascinating because it's all going to be playing out in about 4 weeks' time.
And yet they tied 14-14. Yeah. In Europe, of course, the Europeans retaining the cup. I'm excited to see the sequel. And if Stacey Lewis can get her revenge, we got to see the final three selections tomorrow, how she rounds out her team. But if you're a European player with Suzanne Pedersen, you'd love to go in the battle with her leading you on foreign soil.
Absolutely. A lot of fire, a lot of heart, a lot of passion.
Yeah. For Ryan Lavner, I'm George Savarikas. Thanks for spending some time with us on Golf Today.